Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome back to the Theater Podcast, intimate personal conversations with the industry's biggest names. I'm your host, Alan Seals, and our guest for this episode is Sonoya Mizuno. She has an amazing TV and movie career already, including the upcoming Game of Thrones prequel series. I'm super excited to see that. She was such a treat to talk to virtually. We weren't in person. It was over Zoom. Spoiler. watching her on stage in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Just incredible. This is actually her stage debut, or professional stage debut in terms of theater. She's been performing on stage for many years as a ballet dancer, and she moved into TV and film, and then now she's coming back to the stage. I will obviously let her tell that story. So before we get in, find me online on Instagram and Twitter and TikTok. Leave a 5-star rating, just like I'm your Uber driver. And now, everybody, please enjoy this episode with Sonoya Mizuno.
Here you go. One, two, three.
Today's guest is an actress, model, and ballet dancer who may be best known for her roles on the big screen in Ex Machina, Annihilation, Devs, and La La Land. Oh, and Beauty and the Beast, Crazy Rich Asians, and even the Netflix series Maniac. Her upcoming work includes the Game of Thrones prequel series House of the Dragon and another Alex Garland movie called Civil War. She can now be seen starring as Maggie in the off-Broadway production of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, the first off-Broadway production ever allowed by the Tennessee Williams Estate. Sonoya Mizuno, welcome to the Theater Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I love your name, by the way, Sonoya. It's Japanese, obviously. I took 3 years of Japanese in high school. Don't ask me to speak it because I don't remember any of it, but I can.
Well, mine isn't great either, so you're not alone.
Well, where did you were born in Japan, right? And then moved to London?
I was born in Tokyo and moved to the English countryside when I was like 2. But I moved back to Japan in my early 20s because my dad always stayed there, and I was kind of going backwards and forwards between Japan and London in my early 20s for a couple of years. So that's when I got to kind of like learn Japanese a bit and get to know that side of me a bit more.
Was it weird going back, being Japanese and not speaking the language?
Well, interestingly, I think they often think I don't speak Japanese in Japan because I'm mixed race. But you know, for me personally, I feel kind of like, It doesn't feel great because I wish I did. I wish I spoke better. I mean, I speak okay, but I, you know, probably it would sound like a 3-year-old Japanese if I knew what it sounded like.
It's funny. when I grew up in North Carolina, or where I learned, I went to high school in North Carolina, right, where I took the Japanese. So, So all of my Japanese had a little bit of a Southern accent to it.
Oh my God. So interesting.
So it was like, konnichiwa, ohayou gozaimasu, right? Like it was.
I love that.
Yeah, it was a little twangy, and it worked. But at least when I go to Japan now, I can order breakfast. So
yeah, that's pretty impressive. Good for you.
Yeah, it's all right. So I am fascinated by the fact that researching you for this, found out you had a dance background, because obviously know you from movies and TV, and now the stage, which stage debut, we're going to get into that. But your dance background, is that's where you started in performing, right? Before even getting into modeling or acting?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, originally, I when I was a child, I wanted to be an actress because I had an uncle who was a stage actor, and he passed away a long time ago now. But when I was young, he was alive, and he was kind of like I just adored him, so I kind of wanted to follow in his footsteps. But he suggested that I should learn how to dance first, and then I just kind of went to ballet class, and it snowballed, and next thing I knew I was at the Royal Ballet School, and then I was becoming a professional dancer. So yeah, it was very much what I was doing for the first, you know, I started when I was 9, and I kind of stopped when I was 25.
So How tall are you? Am I allowed to ask that?
Yeah, sure. 5'7".
So 5'7". Okay, so you could be a Rockette, right?
Shrunk a bit since I stopped dancing, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah. We have, which is really interesting. I think I was like 5'8 or something, and now I'm 5'7". Because I think, you know, for the whole time when you're dancing, you're elongating your spine. And then if you're not, and you're like in front of the computer, so, you know. But yeah, I'm 5'7". Why do you ask?
Because I guess starting at 9, and I don't know much about the dance world, about like the ballet world, right? Because my background is in musical theater performing, and I've always just said I'm a singer or an actor who moves. I'm not a dancer by any stretch. And I have a couple friends who have become Rockettes, and that's a whole different regime in and of itself. But when I think of ballet, I guess I was going to say, I think you can't, can you be too tall for ballet? Because a lot of men are typically shorter, and you have to pair them up equivalently. And there's a lot of like stereotypical sort of assumptions that both I'm making now, and I think the industry still relies on.
I think it's a bit of both. I think the assumptions are less, are more assumptions than they are truth. Like, you know, I worked in ballet companies with women who were just under 6 foot, I think, and they were slightly more contemporary companies. But I think especially these days, you know, you get all sorts of heights of and types of people. But you know, it's not like the most diverse industry.
Yeah, that's been a criticism for a while, I believe. Mm-hmm. So, well, coming from the Royal Ballet School in London, London is a place that embraces immigrants and non-Caucasian presenting people a lot more than America especially is doing these days. So did you find in that arena, especially in Britain, in London, in the UK, mm-hmm. and that, like, were you touring, doing all of that stuff? And was there a lot of diversity in that area? And I guess, did you ever, and then second part of the question, did you ever come to America and were you able to dance in America?
I didn't dance in America, actually. I danced in the UK and in London and in Scotland and in Ireland. And also I danced for a while in Germany. And I think, you know, ballet is predominantly a kind of white art/sport art, I'd say. But you know, at the same time, I never felt as conscious of my race and background as I do in the acting industry, because casting is never about the way you looked in dance. It was about, you know, your skill, or, you know, what you were good at, or whether you were right for the part. It had nothing to do with where you were from. So I never bumped up against it as much as I do now, I would say.
That's interesting. And yeah, you're totally right. And I guess the representation or lack thereof is probably probably perpetuated by the children of the people who are already in it. So it's kind of this machine of the same people creating the same people, creating the same people. Right. So,
yeah.
So let's do better. We can do better, people.
We can all do better.
We can all do better. And so then how long, I mean, dancing has again, stereotypically, I know very little. Dancing has a short shelf life in terms of, like, if you're in your mid 20s and you have an air quote made it, then like you're over the hill in dance terms. Like, so when
I think you can have a, you know, it depends also, you know, it depends on like what country you're in and things like that. Like in Europe, they have very good, the structure for dancers in the theaters is very good. So a lot of them dance till they're a lot later, until their late 30s or early 40s. And the roles change to more kind of like character based stuff instead of the very kind of difficult technical stuff. And there's less turnover, say, than I think in America, where It doesn't have the structure, the kind of like the support from the government and what have you to keep these places going. So it's like it's more competitive, I think. So I think that people get pushed out a lot quicker. But I think, you know, most people dance in classical companies, I say late 30s, early 40s, which is young. I just turned 36, so I would be, you know, thinking about stopping.
When did you actually stop dancing? So the modeling came in and then the acting, like, what's that progression?
Yeah, I never really did modeling like as a proper job. I think I just, you know, when they needed, models that could move, you know, I would kind of go in and do stuff for that. So I never really like pursued it. It was just kind of a bit of a side hustle because dancing doesn't pay that great either. So I would do that. But I had been thinking about, you know, wanting to act for a long time. And I think it wasn't like a moment where I was like, this is what I have to do now. But, you know, I think that part that in me that was when I was a child that wanted to do it never really went away. And I think that the older I got and the more I kind of experienced things in the dance world that didn't satisfy me, the more I wanted to look at other aspects of life. And it was something that I just kind of thought, well, maybe I should just give it a go and see what happens.
Well, you kind of came out of the gate pretty hard. So Ex Machina was your first feature film, or was?
Yeah.
So that, I mean, that came out of the gate, and that was an amazing, amazing film. And I guess, and you've worked with Alex Garland. It was an Alex Garland production. Mm-hmm. You're now Civil War, that's coming out soon. Are you filming it or already filmed it? I was going to say, it's his fourth thing you've done with him.
Yeah.
I guess, how did you get connected with Alex? Did that relationship start and then he cast you? Or did he keep casting you after the relationship with Ex Machina?
Yeah, it was after Ex Machina. I literally just went, I was in the Scottish Ballet at the time, and I went to my dance modeling agency and I said, look, I want to get into acting. Can you give me some advice? Like, what shall I do? And they said, we don't, you know, it's not really our field, but sometimes we get auditions when they want particular kinds of people. And when I was in there in the meeting, the agent was like, oh, we just got this audition through for this film, and they would you like to go, just try and see what happens. And it was for Ex Machina, and I went, and Alex was there, and I did the audition. He was like, I think you're fantastic, I'm going to give you the job on the spot. And actually, wow. At that time, it was for one of the other robots in the wardrobes, because the Kyoko part had already been cast. And then the girl who was originally supposed to do Kyoko couldn't get a visa or something like that. So he called me and said, can you come back in and audition for this bigger part? And I went back in. And at that time, and I didn't actually, sorry, this is not really making much sense. I was with the Scottish Ballet. They didn't want me to do the movie. So I quit my job with Scottish Ballet, and I thought, I'm just going to go and do this movie. I just had a gut feeling it was the right thing to do. So I left the company and I went to do the film, and it changed my life, but not in the way that like you hear stories about actors getting a job that changed their life, because it's not like I got that job and then it was really easy for me to get jobs after that, because Kyoko was a very particular kind of character, and obviously I wasn't speaking, and so it wasn't like it opened huge, like lots of doors for me or anything like that, but it did, of course it did open some, but the most important thing was it established this relationship with Alex, which has been like the best thing that's, you know, happened to me in terms of my career, because it's been so creatively fulfilling and also just kind of like life-affirming. You know, he's a really amazing person as well as director, so I've learned so much from working with him.
Well, I remember when I was a kid just watching Ben Stiller movie after movie and noticing that it was always the same core group of people. They were always in all the same Ben Stiller movies. And it clicked for me then. I was like, that's what you do. You get in a group of friends that one of you is successful and the rest and brings the rest of you along, and then somebody else gets successful and brings the rest of you along. And it goes that's along with funny. Advice that we've gotten on this podcast so many times is be the person that you that people want to work with the next time.
Totally.
So yeah. I speaks to that. I love that. And then watching Ex Machina, did you ever watch it with your parents? That seems like a little bit of an uncomfortable situation.
No. I did watch it with my brothers and sisters, though, actually. Well, I went when it first came out in the UK. I remember we went to the cinema and watched it. So, yeah.
Did you warn them? You're like, okay, fam, listen, you're going to see a lot of me.
I think I did. I mean, I also warned them about House of the Dragon, which is, you know, coming out soon. I was like, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I'm going to watch it with you. I'm not sure you guys should watch it either.
Yeah, House of the Dragon, I guess. I'm so excited about that. And I know that I was going to, like, I was going to ask lots of questions about it, but I know you're probably under, like, horrible NDA. You can't give any spoilers, can't talk about anything.
Yes, it's very locked down.
Yeah, the Marvel universe and Game of Thrones universe. I think those are the two that are the mm-hmm. best kept secrets.
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah, I'm not very good at that.
Well, okay, let's turn off the recording. Click. There we go. Just you and me. Lean in. Okay, so tell me. No, nothing? Okay.
We're going to take a short break. Stay tuned for more of the episode.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
So coming to now, New York City, it's your New York City stage debut, but is it your stage debut completely? Like career-wise, this first professional acting gig?
I've done, yeah.
Wow. Okay. So what then, with all the movies and the career and the TV and whatnot that you've done, was it a conscious choice to not try stage what brought you here?
I really wanted to do a play. I've been wanting to do a play for a long time. I think I definitely missed being on stage from dancing. And also I just had a feeling that it was a challenge that I really needed and that would really help me grow as an actor. So it was definitely conscious. And I it's kind of hard if you didn't go to one of the big conservatories in London for acting to get into theatre there. They're quite snobby about it. So, you know, I'd said to my agents, they were very conscious that I wanted to do it. And my wonderful agent in New York, David Kolodner, this was one of the first things he sent me, or maybe the first. And I think, you know, because they are kind of a bit of a renegade theatre group, if you would say,
mm-hmm.
they were willing to take a chance and, you know, got the job, which was very surprising to me because, you know, at the time when I auditioned for it, I wasn't really working and I was feeling a little bit frustrated, as you do as an actor. And I was thinking, well, you know, it's a huge audition. They sent loads of Act One text. And I was like, I'm just going to really try and work on this as a piece of work and, you know, try and have a go at the accent and all that stuff. And I never really expected that it would go anywhere because I thought, you know, it's in New York and there's so many people who could play the part here. So actually, like, sometimes I get weird kind of surreal moments. I'm actually here doing Tennessee Williams. And that's like so weird.
Mm-hmm.
Like, fuck, shit.
You're still based out of London, right? You're not in New York full time, right?
No. Yeah.
So you're based out of London. I assume the audition was probably virtual because everything is these days.
Yes, I had to do 2 self-tapes. Yeah.
And so you've got this theater agent, and you're right. Like, out of all the amazing people in New York, you know, yeah, they cast you, and it's I love the choice, and didn't realize how thick your British accent was, because like in the middle of the play, I'm just like, yeah, this woman is from Mississippi, right? Like the Southern accent is strong in that one.
Yeah.
I was very impressed. The whole production was phenomenal. I had actually never seen a production before, but did you know, I guess, sort of the, were you aware of the importance of the play happening in the first place, meaning that the Tennessee Williams estate is always very controlling about who and what they allow to happen?
Yeah, I kind of find it amazing that they like letting them do it. It's like, how did you guys do this? How did you guys pull this off? But yeah, it's just really cool. And I have so much, respect for Tennessee Williams and his plays that I feel, I really feel very lucky to be doing it. And also I feel a bit like, oh my God, like, I don't know. It's like, I almost feel like, I hope he's like, okay. He's like turning in his grave that I'm doing it. Like, I'm English. And he's probably like, what is this English girl doing my play for? You know, but you know,
well, given how progressive he was and how,
yes,
at the, especially at the time, like talking about closeted homosexuality and everything, yeah, that you have to deal with in this play, it's heavy material, death and whatnot.
Yeah,
they came out in the '50s.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, 1955. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's incredible to me how well it was done. And you were, I was at opening night, so I saw the talk back. Do you know the story of how this sort of renegade production company brought this to Off-Broadway and landed the star power that it did?
I think they had a very, because I guess they were going to put it up 2 years ago and then COVID and what happened. But they've really persevered, and I guess there's something really amazing about that, because you know, here we are, we put it on. I think at all points they thought it was actually never going to happen, but because, you know, obviously we were going to do it in January, and then I think I was literally about to fly out, and I, you know, they decided to cancel it. So it always felt like it was never going to happen. So I think it's just a kind of like, it's one of those miracle kind of situations that it actually did.
So what happened then for you? I guess, what's the timeline then? So you came to the production when, knowing initially that it was going to happen in January?
November. It was late. So I only would have had like 2 months, if that. I think I got the job in November, and then in December, they, just before Christmas, they decided to cancel. And then they kind of were hoping that it would happen now, but it wasn't confirmed until the beginning of the year. And I guess what we kept doing Zoom reads of the play every like month or so, and Matt and I would also rehearse on. But also I just kind of like used that time to really, for example, like train my voice, which I had not done before. And I worked with a voice coach in London, for amazing woman, Paula Stevens, for many weeks and months, and was working on the dialect and stuff like that. I had like, I was doing other jobs as well. So it wasn't like I just had that time to work on Maggie, but I had time to kind of let her seep into me over the course of 6 months.
Well, originally, knowing that it was going to happen in January, 2 months, I mean, I don't know how fast you memorize, but the dialogue alone that you have to memorize for Act One is insane.
I had memorized the dialogue by the beginning of December, but I wouldn't have been able to do it. You know, it's like memorizing and then actually like, you know, I mean, and still every day in performances, I'm like, oh yes, that could mean that, or this means that, or, you know, there's so much, it's so heavy. There's so much to discover all the time. And I'm sure I'll keep discovering stuff until after we've finished, you know? So even getting the dialogue, which is crazy, it's so much dialogue, but just kind of understanding the dialogue and also trying to put the language and the voice on top. My friend who came to see it the other day, he's like, it's like you put all the dials up to hard for yourself. And I was like, I know, it's true. But I feel like I'm, you know, I really wanted to do this for me. And I feel like I'm learning so much. So I'm really glad to be doing it.
Oh, yeah, it's an experience that you'll never forget. And I've always been very, very much an advocate of that if you're not uncomfortable, you're not learning.
It's so true. And you also have to fail. You have to, like, get on the stage and, you know, it has to feel not good for quite a few times. And it's hard. It's hard to be that uncomfortable, but it really helps you grow.
That's a lot of layers I want to peel back on that, because there's several points where you can get used to something and then there's another layer of uncomfortability, because first you're going through the phases, you're auditioning, you realize you get the audition. Oh, I'm uncomfortable because I have to put the audition together. Oh, I got it. Now I'm uncomfortable. Okay, I'm sitting with this. Now I got the script. Holy shit, it's like 5 million pages long. And now I got to memorize that. So now you've got it. Now you got to find the character. Then you got to find the accent. Then, like, and then you get under lighting on stage with the costume, which in and of itself is almost non-existent. So there's the emotional vulnerability and the physical vulnerability, which I suspect is like, it does all that kind of just disappear at this point now that you've opened?
Interesting. I think yes and no. I think my relationship with it all changes. And, you know, sometimes I kind of, like I said, when I was saying about sometimes I feel like I'm in a surreal situation, sometimes I get those moments where I'm like, oh my God, I'm like on stage in a tiny pair of pants and like speaking in a Southern accent, you know, and I have to kind of like get back into the focus of the moment. But I guess it's like each part is like a challenge, and you're trying to like not conquer it, but, you know, get through it and just add this layer to the performance. But I feel like in a way I don't want to completely forget about all those things, because I might I don't want to like get lazy about it, you know. Like, I read this every day before I go in. I say the whole thing out loud in the accent, and not to act it, but just to make sure that I still remember the rhythms and I have the Tennessee Williams grammar is so specific, and the ellipses and the commas and what have you. And so I read it, and so because I don't want to forget it, I want to keep it alive. So I try not to forget too much. I think if I, it's a funny dance though, isn't it? Because you don't want to hold on too tight that you can't just, you know, be alive to the moment.
Sure. I guess there's a point where it's sort of like putting on the costume, putting on the wardrobe, makeup, the lights, you walk into this to the stage and the smell triggers muscle memory. Mm-hmm. And there's a point where you just become the character. And so Maggie is this neurotic, sex-crazed, weird woman who's lying about this and that and whatever. And so obviously I think the farther that is from normal reality, and this has been my experience, the easier it is to fall into this character once you find it, because you have to completely detach from yourself and just let yourself go to what's on the page.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I really like having that experience. I like to play people that are far away from me. I think it's, there's something about it, it's much more freeing, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it gives you an excuse to try on different faces.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which I really love about acting in general. And I think there's a lot of find your tribe, find your chosen family, that kind of vernacular, for lack of a better word, I guess. But yeah, so if you're uncomfortable in who you are, I found a lot of people that they're attracted to the stage, they're attracted to performing because it gives them a focus. It gives them a forward-looking momentum to try on things that they might otherwise be uncomfortable doing.
Yeah, it's so true.
Yeah. What's been your most favorite thing now about the stage schedule, the stage performance?
I love the whole thing. I love the kind of like the rehearsal process. I wish our rehearsal process was longer, but you know, it can't be helped with these kind of small things, I guess. But I loved going to the theater every day and rehearsing, you know, day after day, because new thing, you discover so much new stuff, and just the environment of being in a theater. So it feels actually very comforting for me, because I think it was so part of my childhood and my teenagehood and early 20s that it feels something about being on stage and being backstage and that kind of thing just feels very right for me. So I've loved all of that. And, you know, even just like being in the dressing room with the women, and it's a lovely thing. I think I really love it. It really suits me. It makes me feel very uncomfortable, as we said, in many ways, but just the whole environment of it suits me, I think.
Is there another, looking ahead, another type of role or role specific role that you've always looked at that you're like, I would love to try that, or that looks so unusual I could never do it, but yet, again, talking about being uncomfortable, is it something that you would want to jump into?
I would really like to do Shakespeare, because I think it's something that I've never, like, I never could have imagined when I started acting that I'd ever, you know, could do a Shakespeare play. But now I think maybe I could. And I love Shakespeare, so I think I would really like to do that. But that would be scary.
Talking about...
But, you know, I think I would have said that if I hadn't have done this play. You know, I needed to have done this to realize that actually I can keep pushing, which is a good thing.
So there are three questions I ask everyone to wrap up every episode. The first one just simply is, what motivates you?
You know, my family motivates me. My family, my brothers and sisters. I feel very connected to them, and yeah, it's very easy for me. Like when I have hard days, that's the thing that kind of pushes me through. I kind of do it for them, to be honest.
All right. What advice would you give to your younger self and younger people listening now starting out down a similar path?
I would just say to myself to like to let it happen a bit more, you know, to like not hold on so tightly. Because I think things happen the way they're meant to happen. And I think I was always trying to make things happen instead of letting things happen.
Interesting. All right. There's more to unpack there, but you know, that's a whole separate episode. Okay, last question. If you could only see one show for the rest of your life, but you can see it as many times as you want, what would you see?
Oh my God. One show for the rest of my life. That's so hard. What would I see? I don't know if I can answer that. What would you see?
It changes. My answer changes. I don't know if I could answer this. I ask this to everybody, and I don't know if I have an answer. Sometimes I say Rent because it was the show that got me to realize that I love musical theater. Mm-hmm. Sometimes during the pandemic, I was like, I need to laugh and I need it to be different, even though it's the same show. So I would say Freestyle Love Supreme, because that's improv and changes every time. And then there's classics there. I mean, Ragtime, Sweeney Todd.
I think I'd see a classical ballet.
Yeah.
I think I would, you know, if I had to see it over and over. That's so hard. I think I might, but hang on. It can be different productions of the show.
Sure. Sure. We'll get,
oh yeah. I think I'd see a ballet because then you could see like modern version or a classical version or something like that. So maybe I'd see like Romeo and Juliet. Oh my God, I see Romeo and Juliet, but then you can also see the acting or the dance version. How about that?
Okay.
The acting version, you can see the classical ballet version, you can see the modern contemporary dance version. That's pretty good.
All right, I'll go with that. All right, so where can we find you on social media?
Oh, you can't.
No?
No, you can't, yeah.
Why, is that an active choice of just staying away from the haters?
Yeah, I used to have an Instagram, but I don't anymore.
Well, yeah. good for you, because
yeah, I feel like my brain, my mental health.
that is such a good choice. If I didn't need it, I probably wouldn't have it either. Who knows? But anyway, I am on social media, theater_podcast, Facebook/officialtheaterpodcast. Leave a rating and a review. Jukebox the Ghost gave us our intro and outro music. And Sonoya, thank you so, so much. I've enjoyed this.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much.
Take a deep breath, make the world a little colorful.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.